This is At the Edge of Canada, Indigenous Research, a show about Indigenous researchers doing research with Indigenous communities in Canada and beyond. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Falconulette, and I hope you will enjoy this show. Tensei. So, welcome back to At the Edge of Canada. I have this very special guest, Tim Tallbear, a Dakota scholar from the University of Austin in Texas, who came to the University of Manitoba here this week, and she was giving a lecture in Women's and Gender Studies. And her title for her lecture was Combating Colonial Technoscience, Lessons from the Front Lines. So welcome, Kim.
Tensei. Thank you.
So what brought you, why did you decide to do a lecture on technoscience?
Well, that's the meat of what I do. So I have a book that just was published this month by the University of Minnesota Press, or I guess last month, Native American DNA, Tribal Belonging, and the False Promise of Genetic Science. And that's the culmination of about 10 years of research looking at the implications for Indigenous peoples, mostly in the U.S. and a little bit Canada, of the mapping of the human genome.
Mm-hmm. So that's a very controversial subject.
Well, it has been, right, because the human population genetics research, which is the bit of that that I look at, so it looks at the migration of peoples around the globe. Historically, it's looking at how modern-day populations are related to one another, where they think they trace back to in terms of their continental ancestry. For Indigenous people, that can come into conflict with their own origin stories. There's also the history of drawing blood from people in order to get DNA in ways that was not properly consented. So there are a couple of axes around which the controversy happens. And for me, I felt like it's really important for Indigenous peoples ourselves to learn enough of the science to sit at the table in a really knowing way, because we live governed by science. If we're going to make an intervention that's going to serve our interests, we have to be able to speak that language to some degree. We will resist better and collaborate better and shape the research better if we know some of the science.
Now, there was a researcher, I think, that published some research about the genome and the origins of Aboriginal peoples in North America. And I guess he does this for populations around the world. And he was trying to trace this back, and he said, you know, there were actually three successive waves coming to North America.
There's debate about that one, two, or three waves.
Yeah. And he was able to trace back, you know, depending on where you're from, to one genitor in the entire lineage for certain peoples, like the Dene. They come from apparently Northern Asia or something like that.
Yeah.
And and that was actually a bit of a controversy on Indian Times or the an Indian newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, so is that true, the Bering Strait? Because it's related to the Bering Strait theory.
Right. So for me, I have no trouble accepting that I have some genetic sequences. And I mean, well, we're all genetically related, right? We're the same species. I mean, all living things with DNA are related, in fact, not just humans. I mean, Jonathan Marks is a biological anthropologist who points out in his book that we have 40% the same sequences as daffodils. So we are then 40% daffodil. I mean, what does that mean, right? So I have no trouble understanding that I have some particular sequences in common with people who now reside in what we call East Asia or Siberia. I do not believe that we all came from Africa, and let me explain what I mean. The continent of Africa is what we now call that continental landmass. It's a relatively modern concept. Some people decided to name that landmass Africa, and then they loaded it down with all of these racist and colonial narratives about backwardness and darkness and savagery. So you cannot invoke the concept of Africa without invoking all of that colonial history and all of those racist narratives. The other thing that happens is when Africa and the narrative of we are all African gets invoked by genome scientists, quite often what happens is they are always using relatively contemporary African populations or other Indigenous populations to represent the ancient ancestors of all of us. So when they go looking to sample populations in the world today, they're looking for what they consider the quote-unquote purest samples. And then they represent those living peoples as somehow more ancient or more close to the origins of humanity. Well, what that does is it's drawing on these long-standing race narratives where you've got some peoples in the world back in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century being viewed as less evolved. So Indians were viewed as barbarians. Their Negroes, in the terminology of the time, were viewed as just above apes, and they had stopped evolving. There was this notion of cultural evolution. You started with savages, then you went to barbarians, then you went to civilized people, which of course were always whites or Europeans. So you've got those kinds of stories still conditioning the way that people go out and sample, the way that they think about contemporary populations.
Now, a lot of those scientists, I'm sure, would say, well, you know, we're being very objective because it's Western empirical science based on, you know, test and right. trial and the, you know, the tried and true and tested yeah. methods that we've been using for 300, 400 years. So what would you say to a scientist?
Well, like I'm a feminist theorist of science and technology. So I do feminist science studies within that field. And feminist theorists have been very good at theorizing precisely why nobody stands nowhere. Nobody looks at the world from nowhere. There is this notion that Donna Haraway, one of my mentors, talks about, the God trick, and that Western science pulls the God trick, attempts to pull the God trick. We think of God as this omnipotent being who is everywhere at once, who sees everything but stands nowhere. You know, we don't think of God necessarily as having as standing in one particular place, but God is omniscient. And science, Western science, attempts to have that same God-like gaze. But we all come from particular cultures and historical lineages. We all ask research questions based out of our particular set of experiences, right? There is not, scientists don't randomly choose their hypotheses. Their hypotheses are conditioned by who they are and where they come from. Now, that's the point of peer review. We check one another. My argument is, if all we've got is a bunch of white, Western, heterosexual men who are basically controlling most of the research, we're not getting true peer review. We need a more diverse set of people thinking and asking questions and doing research and coming at this from particular points of view. And feminists say that's strong objectivity. So what they do is they say objectivity is not neutral because nobody is capable of being neutral. The way that we strengthen objectivity is by bringing more minds and more perspectives, more standpoints into the way that we do research. Mm-hmm. And then we're strengthening that peer review. That's what I would say to them.
So. Because I did contact one at one point to ask mm-hmm. about his research that he published, but he felt it was controversial enough that he didn't want to talk about it.
Right.
He was perhaps a little nervous.
On camera? Well, yeah, he should be nervous. I mean, science, this is why I'm a real advocate for crossing these hard disciplinary boundaries. You have a lot of people who do what I do, not necessarily in relationship to indigenous populations, but you have a lot of people who are working in what we call science and technology studies, and that's social studies of science. And so it's basically social scientists and humanists engaging with the hard sciences and looking at their histories and doing anthropology of science. And we, if we're going to do that work, we have to not only know our social science and our humanities work, but we also have to learn some of the hard science that we deal with. So I've had to take genetics classes and classes in biological anthropology. Now I am not qualified to run my own laboratory and do that kind of work, but I have to know enough about what they do to converse with them. But conversely, most of the biological scientists that I work with don't know anything about social theory. They don't know anything about histories of indigenous cultures. They don't know anything about federal Indian policy. All of those things that I have to think about when I think about how genetics intersects with our lives. Mm-hmm. And so what I advocate is that we need people out there making policy decisions and doing science who understand not only genetics, but they also understand something about history and policy, because all of those bodies of knowledge, we need all of those together to make smarter decisions and to do research that I think really serves a broader array of our society and not just some scientist in the ivory tower who's got a question that he or she is particularly interested in. Mm-hmm. So,
now, your title of your thing was Combating Colonial Technoscience, Lessons from the Front Lines. This is a very military aspect to
Probably because I'm a U.S. American, right? Yeah.
Why such a title?
It was catchy. I think about indigenous people, though, that we've been, my co-author, Jenny Reardon, who is the head of the Science and Justice Program at the University of California, Santa Cruz, she's a feminist science studies person as well, non-native, though. She has said, and we've written about this, that indigenous peoples have kind of been the canary in the coal mine in terms of biomedical ethics. So indigenous pushback against unethical research, against colonial research, has produced really interesting innovations in the field of bioethics. And so we really are on the front lines. So, you know, what happens to us doesn't just only happen to us. You have other marginalized populations that have been that where research has been performed upon them in also unethical ways, but it's that notion of producing innovation mm-hmm. and sort of us sort of being out front.
Now you also came here and you're just talking about the idea of residential schools.
I opened up the talk with that to say that happened in the mid-20th century, right?
Yeah.
But I gave examples of more recent research in the 1990s and then in the early 21st century that I think is drawing upon those same foundational narratives of difference, of othering Indigenous people. And my point was, we may say, well, the residential school research, that nutritional research performed on, you know, malnourished children and near starving or starving elders, well, that wouldn't happen today. Well, in fact, we have the same narrative grounding unethical research today. So we can't just say that was in the past, it no longer happens, which is quite often what scientists want to do. Well, we learn from our mistakes, we would never do that again. No, some of those similar types of things are happening, but it may look a little bit less obvious to us today.
So is ethics a central role or central part of your work?
I am not a bioethicist, but I work with bioethicists, and I've student taught bioethics before. I'm somewhat familiar with the field, but there's a lot of law involved in that, and I am more of an anthropologist and a humanist, and so I'm really interested in the way that these longstanding stories condition the way research gets done. But one of the, I think it was a graduate student in my talk yesterday here at the University of Manitoba, pointed out that the law is really important, and we can do all the theorizing and dissecting of stories and discourses that we want, but we're faced with what the law will accommodate. That is absolutely right, and that's why there are a lot of people working in bioethics and in science and technology studies and in Indigenous engagements with genomics that are really thinking about the law. So we need people with multiple sets of expertise to come at this problem, and that's why I say this is a battle line. You know, and not that we always need to consider people doing genetic research our enemies. There's another talk I give where I talk about, I use polyamory or plural relationships, mm-hmm. non-monogamy as a metaphor for multidisciplinarity. And I talk about not just always battling with people on the other side of that fence, not always battling with biological scientists, but sometimes you lay down your weapons. Sometimes you decide to go home with the enemy. Sometimes you socialize with them. You learn how to use some of their tools. I mean, you can't do this work and assume that you can be disciplinarily pure or politically pure. You know, there are times to fight, and then there are times to lay down your weapons and learn how to collaborate. And so I look for collaborative scientists, politically critical scientists, scientists who love their science, but who are not under the illusion that you can depoliticize science. There is always already politics and history at the core of the scientific enterprise. Mm-hmm. And I look for scientists to collaborate with who understand that, and they still want to do good science, and they don't want to exploit subjects who are mindful of politics.
So are you an activist?
Well,
scholar?
I would not claim to be an activist because I don't want to overstate my expertise. Activists are also technological people. They cultivate and use social technologies of organizing. They are highly sophisticated organizers. Those are social technologies. I don't do that. I'm not an expert in that, and I would not claim to be. I don't want to demean the work that the serious, sophisticated intellectual and theoretical work that activists do in the world. I work within the academy. There are probably some people within the academy, because of the kinds of language that I use, because I embrace an explicitly political project, that would say I'm an activist scholar. But I'm comparing myself to activists, not academics who don't want to engage with activism. So no, I'm not an activist.
So you don't, believe in the pure ivory tower then?
No, and I've been telling graduate students here at Manitoba, my mother was a community planner. She helped build educational institutions, low-income housing projects, both in rural Native communities in the United States and in urban Indian communities. I was partly raised in Minneapolis and St. Paul, went back and forth between there and the reservations in South Dakota. And I have always seen from the earliest days, my mom's not a PhD, but planners do research for change. And that's why I got a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in planning. And so for me, it's always been, research is always for change. Then I came and did a PhD, but I did not get that example out of the academy. I got that example from community planners and community activists, from artists, from tribal leaders, from the people that I saw growing up who were trying desperately in the wake of the American Indian Movement to build tribally controlled schools, to get away from the racist institutions that we had on reservations, and to build native urban Indian controlled institutions in the Twin Cities. And they all did research, but they weren't PhDs, but they all did research. So when I came into the academy, I'm like, all right, I'm going to get that PhD, those letters behind my name. I'm going to learn how to do this properly. But my point of reference was community researchers, not ivory tower. So,
and because you're in women's studies, or anthropology.
I'm in anthropology, but I do feminist scholarship, yeah.
So how do you feel the current state of feminism is in Native communities?
You know, I came into feminism through the side door, so I would not have called myself a feminist 10 years ago. I was always really concerned with issues of race and indigenous sovereignty. But when I started to engage with science and technology studies, it was the feminists who were making the same kinds of critiques of colonial science as indigenous people make. And I thought, oh, we need to be at the same table. That's also how I came to queer theory. Queer theorists were criticizing science for de-animating, for dehumanizing people they considered perverse and deviant, right? And so we all, queer theorists, feminists, and indigenous theorists, need to be at the same table in this project to reform techno-scientific fields. So within indigenous studies, I would, was that your question, indigenous studies? Or within native communities?
Yeah.
I'm not sure there's, you know, I think a lot of the, I probably am the only woman in my extended family who calls herself a feminist, but they all sure act like they are. They run everything. They're independent women. I think articulating ourselves as feminists specifically might help a little bit. I think it because feminists have done a really good job, again, of theorizing unequal relations. And I think that's helpful in terms of also reforming our relationships with men and other kinds of institutions in Native communities. So I think it would be great if more Native women explicitly identified as feminist. I get why they don't, because they view feminism as a largely white woman's movement, but that's not really true. We've got a lot of women of color feminists who are really problematizing the claims that white women have made on behalf of all women, right? Because they get to be all women, the universal woman. Well, we need more indigenous feminists to say, no, you don't get to represent all of womanhood, right? Your standards aren't universal standards. We're not like that.
So what role do you see men as having to play within
in feminism?
Yeah.
Well, men should be feminists. Because, right, there's that bumper sticker, right? Feminism is the radical idea that women are people too. I mean, you know, there's at some base level where that's right. And so why wouldn't a man buy into that project?
So, but
equal, right?
But even in a lot of white or even, you know, Euro-Canadian cultures, there's a lot of young women who don't identify as feminists.
And in the United States as well, right?
But yet, you know, they take on many of the traits of feminism. So what do you think about that idea of the slut walk?
What is that?
Oh, you haven't heard about the slut walk?
No.
Oh, they've taken, it was a movement, I guess, here in Canada. In a couple of places in the United States where women, young women especially, would take the word slut because there was a judgment from some rape case that, you know, or, you know, that...
Oh, slut shaming.
Yeah, and so the women took the name and then they would go out and march, you know, and dress up very provocatively. And so it caused quite a rift in the feminist movement in Canada here.
Oh, interesting. Okay, see, I'm not reading mainstream feminist stuff. If it doesn't deal with biology, I'm not reading it. I have a couple of thoughts. I don't really believe in reclaiming the word slut. I think the word slut attaches an inherently negative connotation to sex. And I think sex is inherently good as long as it's fully consensual and it's safe. You know, we got to be safe post-HIV, definitely.
I have been speaking to Dr. Kim Tallbear, who is an associate professor of anthropology and Native American and Indigenous Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Kim has a blog called Kim Tallbear, Indigeneity and Technoscience, and she was at the University of Manitoba giving a lecture about Indigenous peoples and technoscience.
You have been listening to At the Edge of Canada Indigenous Research, a show which interviews researchers and people of prime importance to Indigenous issues. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Falconillette, a program director with the Aboriginal Focus Programs at the University of Manitoba. If you wish to hear past episodes or find out more information, you may find it on our website at theedgeofcanada.com. At theedgeofcanada.com. Ikose kotwam.
This song is entitled Bread Revolution, an Indigenous Anthem. It's about bringing people together to consider the issues facing Indigenous peoples here in North America and South America. May we consider those issues of human rights and Indigenous rights. May we all come together to create a better world. Tapwe.
Peoples together as one, fighting for our children, for they are the sun. Oh, red revolution, it's time to unite, it's time to fight for human rights. Oh, red revolution.
Let's make a baby at the Great Spirit. children will have fear. Just sing your song. Your children are strong. Sing your song, your children.